From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On today's show, we look at some opportunities and challenges facing rural Kansas.
They buy products here, support local businesses, buy gas. That money's coming back into the county.
Hear what Kansas City was like hundreds of millions of years ago.
Kansas City must have been an exceptional environment back when the seas covered the area about 300 million years ago.
Plus, we join up with a local man on the run. For decades, he's been jogging through the U.S. with a very simple mission.
And a new music festival blossoms in KCK.
You go to shows growing up that are almost in houses or in basements similar to this.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. With rural populations declining, the state of Kansas wants people to know that it can pay to move to rural Kansas, literally. In 2011, the state launched a one-of-a-kind program offering financial incentives for settling in one of the 50 designated counties. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, Justine Grieve finds that despite cuts across the state budget, these rural opportunity zones have lots of support.
It's 1 p.m. on a weekday at Be Defined Fitness in Belleville, Kansas. This is a quiet time for owner Kendra Short. Later this evening, her husband Shannon will come to help at the fitness center, and she'll teach dance lessons in her studio upstairs. Right now, with a break in her schedule, Kendra talks about her dreams for life in Belleville. She says starting a business in her rural hometown wasn't always part of her plan.
When I first graduated high school, there would have been no way that I would have told you that I was moving back here. I definitely wanted to get out there and see.
Now, in her mid-20s, Kendra sees Republic County in north central Kansas as the perfect place to settle down.
As we got married, though, and as we're thinking about starting a family, Belleville, there's no other place.
But they weren't sure about the timing. The couple lives in Salina, a much bigger city about an hour away. Kendra started a dance studio in Belleville 3 years ago. They bought the fitness center last year, and they started to think about moving. That's also when they heard about the state's Rural Opportunity Zone program, known as ROZ.
We say that everything keeps lining up and that everything happens for a reason.
Now the time is right, and the price is right. $15,000 right. You see, the ROZ program encourages growth in 50 rural counties in Kansas. Move there from out of state, and you'll get a Kansas income tax waiver for 5 years. If you graduated college with student loans, the state will repay $15,000 of those for moving to a ROZ county, even if you live in Kansas already. It's a great deal for the Shorts, who together have about $90,000 in student loans. They recently closed on property in Belleville and plan to start building a house this summer. Now that they've done their part, they're counting on the state to do its part. The Shorts are two of 800 ROZ applicants. Soon, they hope to be among the 450 who've been approved. Chris Harris is the ROZ program director.
Almost 70% of the people that do move there say that ROZ was an important or the most important factor in their decision. Some of me will go so far as saying it's what put us over the edge, and it's what will keep us here. They'll lay down roots. They'll become part of the community.
Regrowing the roots of rural Kansas isn't cheap. The state has allocated $1 million a year for ROZ, and the counties themselves cover half of student loan repayment. Harris says it's a necessary expense.
In many areas in rural Kansas, the employment problem isn't always a matter of lack of jobs, but rather a lack of people to fill the necessary jobs.
Harris says the program aims to attract young professionals in fields such as healthcare and education who will end up settling down in rural Kansas. Student loan benefits are portioned out over 5 years
to get them to not only come there, but to stay there.
State Senator Marcy Francisco isn't so sure the program actually does that. She says it rewards people coming in from out of state while ignoring those who have lived and worked here all along.
It's not very targeted in terms of who it helps. So it doesn't help people who are there to stay.
And in a state that's getting national attention for its efforts to cut its budget, she argues, it doesn't make sense to start waiving income tax and repaying people's student loans.
At the same time we're saying you can get a tax deduction, we were saying we don't have enough taxes in Kansas to pay for the arts, to support public broadcasting, to support expansion of Medicare or other ways we can help our rural hospitals.
But Luke Mayen, co-director of economic development in Republic County, says the Roz math works. The county pays $1,500 a year to a Rural Opportunity Zone recipient, and each year it gets about half that back in property tax.
And that doesn't even count the sales tax. They buy products here, support local businesses, buy gas. That money's coming back into the county. If they had students, that money would go into the local school systems, providing more jobs. So the multiplier effect would definitely recoup that money less than 10 years for each of these people.
Of course, that plan only works if recipients stay in rural Kansas. Program Director Harris thinks they will. Nearly 80% of applicants have some sort of ties to rural Kansas. They know what they're signing up for. Kendra Short knows all about the difficulties of living in a rural area. She named her dance studio The Turning Point, in part because she hopes it will be one.
When I was growing up, my parents had to drive me an hour each way for dance lessons, and they did that 2 to 3 days a week. I had always said that if we did end up back in this area, that I was going to start something in Belleville so that kids would have the opportunity and parents wouldn't have to drive that far.
In the 3 years since she opened her studio, membership has grown from 30 students to around 100, and that in a community of just under 2,000. It's perhaps with stories like this in mind that the state is looking to expand the program. In early April, the Senate passed a bill adding 23 counties to the program. It's still under consideration in the House. Yet, despite the early buzz, it will be years before the state knows if Roz will bring long-term growth to rural communities. It may find it takes more than a few dance studios and a few million dollars to bring about a real turning point. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Justine Grieve.
This next story is about someone you may have seen around town, maybe on the plaza or near City Hall or at Arrowhead Stadium on game days. We're talking about a guy who runs miles at a time, day and night, through rain and snow, dressed as Superman. We were curious about why, so we sent out Alana Gordon with her running shoes to find out the story behind the Midtown Superman.
It's not hard to spot Michael Wheeler, especially if you frequent spots on his regular jogging route. For Levi Van Zandt, a driver for a private transportation service, it seems like Wheeler is everywhere.
I see him all over the place. Off Southwest Trafficway a lot. You'll see him at the plaza running. I see him all over the place.
When Wheeler first jogged by Ryan Jones, who often sits outside Broadway Cafe in Westport, his reaction was,
"What the hell?"
Jones has since grown accustomed to the unusually dressed Wheeler. He runs by here all the time, and in some ways is just another part of the colorful Midtown landscape.
I find it a little weird, but, you know, it's working for him. He obviously enjoys what he's doing, so.
As for Michael Wheeler, he gets a big kick out of all this attention. Wheeler's a slim 61-year-old black man with a finely trimmed white beard. He runs in his homemade Superman outfit almost every day. It consists of a red hat, a bright blue t-shirt with the Superman symbol across the chest, and of course, a long, shiny red cape. Wheeler tells me the cape is key.
When I put it on, I start feeling the strength, almost like in a movie, like Superman. I hit that door, and I get my energy and my strength.
Wheeler says he and this cape have covered a lot of terrain, not just in Kansas City. He was in Los Angeles for a big run last month. He's jogged like this through several states in between, including Texas, Kansas City's Wheeler's home base. I meet up with him on a recent morning outside his Midtown apartment. That's a starting point for his daily runs.
All right, you ready?
Okay.
We head east toward Main Street.
We'll make this right. We'll make it.
You going to make it?
Yeah, come on. We'll make it.
Going through the light.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's an art in running. It's almost like a dance, you know, like a ballet dancer. You just got this strap, but it ain't running. I try to run the race with you.
So is it about speed?
No, it's not about speed, just about pacing yourself. And the more you pace yourself, the more the more energy you have. A lot of runners, they overpace themselves. That's why they be tired.
Wheeler tells me he loves to run. He's formally or informally done dozens of big races over the span of nearly 40 years. He's run the Boston Marathon. He says he's been through every state, twice. He says he's done this by living simply and from getting some support from people who offer it along the way. Wheeler likens himself to the classic film character Forrest Gump, who ran through the country witnessing major historic moments.
This has been my passion all my life. Just like little Forrest. In the movie, he ran from the bullies. That's how I did. That's how I got into running. I got tired of getting beat up, so I learned how to run.
But while Forrest ran, well, to run, Wheeler has a more specific cause. He's running for Jesus.
I'm an evangelist, but I'm a running evangelist. I run to spread the good news around.
At a closer look, one can see that Jesus is printed across the Superman symbol on Wheeler's shirt and hat. The phrase, Jesus saves, is embroidered on Wheeler's red cape. Wheeler says he runs like this to motivate people, to put a smile on their faces.
All right. Yeah, all right. You know, people need inspiration, need hope. No matter where all so much going on, you know, people are fearful. But, you know, you just got to keep on living your life, you know, can't fear.
Wheeler says he's at peace when he runs. That and his faith are what lifted him from a serious depression and bout with drugs when he was young and drafted in the military. He comes from a religious family, too. His father and grandfather were preachers, as were several uncles. Wheeler's a big football fan as well, so on game day, he'll do what he calls Jericho runs, or seven laps around Arrowhead, to pray a little bit for the Chiefs.
I have to stop for a minute. So we have run a total of two blocks.
Yes.
And in those two blocks, you've gotten fist pumps, and you've gotten really weird looks, and you've gotten high fives. Is this typical?
Oh, yeah.
It's comical, because that's the first time he come flying in here. Not literally. But I couldn't help from laughing. I said, Michael, what's this all about?
Former Mayor Pro Tem Alvin Brooks is a longtime friend of Wheeler's. They used to be neighbors. Brooks says Wheeler's Superman outfit is a new thing. Brooks directs the ad hoc group against crime, and he and Wheeler became close after Wheeler's sister was brutally murdered in the 80s. He says Wheeler did his first runs for Jesus shortly after that.
I don't think he started this running until he joined with the ad hoc group against crime, a men's group. We were marching on crack houses back in the 80s, and crack became a real menace here, an epidemic proportion. And we marched on a crack house right across the street from where his family, and I think they grew up, and right around the corner from where we lived at the time. And he decided to follow, and he's very, very, very religious, and does a lot of reading of scripture. He's a Christian. And he decided to do the walk around, and the wall come tumbling down, and the Jericho wall, and this was seven times around. And during this run, this crack house, little dope dealers came out and hit him and beat him with a board, with a 2x4 board, piece of lumber. And he was laid up for a while and scarred up for a while. And I think that gave him the more impetus to do what he's doing now. And I think he's doing it for justice. He's doing it for his own religious purposes, for Christian purposes that he sees.
How you doing?
Superman! How you doing?
We were in at Crown Center here on 25th and Grand. How y'all doing? Where the young kids are out and about.
There's some of them are looking at you, pointing at you.
Yeah.
So how's your run been going? How are you feeling?
Real good. I feel pretty good. Yeah. Running smooth and pacing myself. And I'm loving running, growing older gracefully. See, it's an art to even getting older. I'm almost 62 now, but I don't mind getting old because it's a goal, staying in shape and trying to get inspiration to other people. It's a lady, 92 years old, still running marathons. And a guy, he's 103, Buster, he's still running marathons too.
After Crown Center, Wheeler heads back to his apartment to take a midday break. I meet up with him there.
Four flights of steps.
An entire wall of Wheeler's studio apartment is covered in photos and news clippings from his travels. A banner that says Salvation Now, House of Prayer, hangs over the window. Wheeler points to a photo of when he met President George H.W. Bush in 1990. The president had famously visited Kansas City then and toured Wheeler's neighborhood to learn how Brooks and others were trying to address the major crime and drug problems at that time.
I'm writing a book. This is a book that I'm putting together.
Can I see a little?
Yes, uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Wheeler shows me a scrapbook.
This is Times Square, New York, right here. This is Hawaii, Alaska.
For a long time before the Superman outfit, Wheeler would travel the country, often wheeling around a big wooden cross. He left Kansas City for a while to do this, and also lived in Seattle, Minneapolis, and Pittsburgh, Kansas. He'd preach on street corners. He still does sometimes. A lot of the photos Wheeler points to in this book are of police.
In Kansas, I got arrested in front of this church, street preaching. Here's the actual policeman arresting me. I took my camera with me, so I took a picture of her.
Why focus on being arrested?
No, it's just like something happens when you go out there to preach, you know. When you come out the four wall now, if I stay in the four walls.
Wheeler says he's been arrested dozens of times. He's not shy about this. It's on a flyer he wrote up about himself. He says it's mainly with policemen who don't know him. He has a good relationship with a lot of them.
He's been arrested so many times, and it's not even funny.
Peggy Wheeler is Michael's sister. The two are really close, even though she doesn't live in Kansas City anymore. Peggy Wheeler fully supports her brother, but admits it was hard going along with the Superman act at first.
At first when he did it and stuff, I was like, oh, Lord, I must, oh, Jesus. I was like, oh, Lord, I really had a hard time, you know, wrapping my mind around that, you know.
She says Wheeler's approach has also changed in recent years. He used to be more confrontational. Wheeler says his relationship with Christianity has also changed. He now describes himself as just a plain believer, no denomination. And he says, unlike when he had just a flag or a shirt that said a religious phrase, he gets a lot more positive attention wearing the Superman outfit. People often approach him and want to talk to
him.
How
you doing? How are you? I'm doing super.
The final stretch of Wheeler's daily run is the plaza in the evening. It's raining out.
So we're on the finish line. It's about three more blocks to the finish line.
Finish line?
Yeah.
What finish line?
On this course. How you doing? On this plaza course, you know. I usually finish up over here and head back.
I see.
And I feel good, so I head on over the Wall Parkway.
We hit another crosswalk. Standing next to Wheeler, also waiting for the green light, is a very tall man who doesn't seem particularly interested in Wheeler.
I ain't gonna do no tall jokes. Well, how's the weather up there?
I'm not gonna do no Jesus Superman jokes, so.
Okay. How you been? Good to see you.
When we reach the finish line at 47th and Pennsylvania, Wheeler decides to wrap up the day doing something he hasn't done here in a while.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? Kansas City, are you ready for some gospel? I didn't say rumble. I didn't say football, baseball, or basketball. But are you ready for the coming of the Lord? Kansas City. Get ready and stay ready, for we're running out of time.
It's around 6 p.m., and there's barely anyone out because of the cold rain. The few people who are out don't pay much attention. One man who does walk by and approach Wheeler is a pastor from Lincoln. The two exchange information, and the pastor invites Wheeler to visit him next time he's in Nebraska. Without any prompts or requests, the pastor then hands Wheeler some money. Wheeler does this for about 10 more minutes, and then he heads home. I ask him if he thinks he'll ever stop.
No, I think I'm running until I take my last breath.
Wheeler says once he gets to his apartment, he'll do some praying, work on his book, and get ready for another day of running. Reporting for KC Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
Up a vision of prehistoric Kansas City. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Now, let's go back in time. Imagine a Kansas City covered by ice sheets and oceans that ebb and flow, and lush rainforests with soaring ferns and palm trees, home to dragonflies with 4 feet wingspans. This was Kansas City eons ago, according to Richard Gentile, who is a geosciences professor emeritus at UMKC. He's curator of the exhibit Kansas City Millions of Years Ago, Reading the Rock, at Commerce Bank's Box Gallery. Susan caught up with Gentile there amid the fossils and illustrations of Kansas City long, long ago. Richard Gentile told her how he became interested in fossils.
Well, it began when I was a child. We lived over in St. Louis County, and I went to a circus, and they had on display the man who was turning to stone. This fellow was lying in a sort of a coffin-like box there, and all he had on was a pair of trunks, but he was just as white as a sheet. They evidently had covered him with talcum powder. But he was turning to stone. Now, they never did really tell you how that was happening. Maybe it was something he was eating, I don't know. But anyway, I was about 6 years old, and that fascinated me. So I decided I wanted to make a fossil, just like this fellow who was becoming a fossil. So I got an apple and a potato, and I climbed up in a tree, and I put it in the fork of the tree. And I came back a few days later, climbed up the tree, and I thought, well, I'm going to find a petrified apple and a potato. But, of course, the birds had pecked holes in it, so I was a little bit discouraged. So I went to my father, and I asked him, well, Dad, how do I make a fossil? Well, he looked at me kind of oddly, just as to say, boy, I have a weird little kid here. But he says, oh, he said, fossils are found in caves. Well, there was a cave about a quarter of a mile from our house. It was in a limestone bluff there, and of course it went back about 75 feet. So I went back into the cave. I took another apple and a potato, and I put it way back in the cave. Came back a couple of weeks later expecting to find my apple and potato petrified, but of course the little cave animals had eaten it, and there was nothing left there but shards of the apple and a potato, so I was pretty discouraged. But then I read somewhere that fossils are dug up out of the earth. So there was a small stream back of our house, and it was sort of had a sand bottom. So I went there, and I dug a hole there in the bottom of the creek there, and I buried my apple and potato. Oh, I came back the next, that was in the fall, I came back the next spring, and I must have dug up that whole creek for 100 feet looking for my apple and potato, but evidently it wasn't the right environment, and of course it probably rotted away, so I was pretty discouraged, and of course, but I have always been interested in geological problems here.
So just generally, and we're going to walk around in a minute, but just generally, what about the Kansas City area made it a good place for fossils and other things to develop?
Well, what we're trying to do here in the Box Gallery is to recreate the geologic history of the greater Kansas City area as seen in the rock record. We're interested in the surface rocks. These are the rocks that you see as you drive along the major highways, and of course they're in layers. And those rocks go back about 300 million years now. That was a time when vast seas covered the interior of the North American continent. And, of course, there were various types of life living in those seas. Most of them were invertebrates. There were some strange-looking fishes. And then, of course, those seas, at times they retreated. And following the seas westward were vast rainforests. And we were on near the equator then, maybe 5 degrees from the equator. And, of course, these vast rainforests, some people call them coal forests because much of the vegetation gave, by altering geologic processes, they became beds of coal. But anyway, these vast rainforests, they left behind a lot of fossil, different types of trees and leaves. Now, we've collected those.
Now, let me ask you, right where we're sitting here, like 10th and Walnut, that was kind of a hotbed of geological creation, wasn't it?
Well, if you want to walk over here, I'll show you a diorama that was created by our illustrator John Babcrock. This is this diorama here on the wall. It, of course, it's the excavation for a large building in 1889. We're at the corner of 11th and Grand Avenue. Now, back in those days, they excavated basements with picks and shovels. And, of course, they didn't have modern-day equipment, and they did it at a rather slow pace. Well, they got down several feet, and they hit a bed of shale, only about 6 inches thick, that contained a excellently preserved group of fossil organisms that once lived in those seas. Now, they collected about 700 slabs with those particular fossils in them. Now, most of them were mostly covered by the surrounding matrix, but of course they didn't have much to do in Kansas City in 1889. There was no radios or TVs, and so they would spend the entire winter there with a needle and a brush removing the matrix around the specimens and bringing them out in relief. Now, they did that to about 400 of those particular slabs, and they're in an excellent state of preservation.
Now, what did they actually find there?
The main organism that they found there, the main invertebrate, is called a crinoid. Now, crinoids, some people call them sea lilies, but they have nothing to do with plants. They're invertebrate organisms. They're closely related to starfishes, sea urchins, and sand dollars. If you take a starfish and turn it upside down and put a stem on it, which is rooting the specimen to the seafloor, you have a crinoid. And those are very elaborate creatures. They're composed of hundreds of little plates. And usually, whenever they die, the plates fall apart, and they're, of course, many times they're broken up by predators or waves, but in this particular case, Kansas City must have been an exceptional environment back when these seas covered the area about 300 million years ago. It was probably a shallow lagoon with an excellent environment for preservation. Sediments like clay was coming in. It rapidly covered these particular creatures as they settled to the bottom, preserving them from oxygen, bacterial decay, and predators. So we had a very excellent type of environment here for the preservation of these organisms. Now, this one here on the wall is called Asiocrinus magnificus, and of course it is a magnificent specimen. It's in the Smithsonian. But our specimens have been found their way into museums and collections throughout the eastern United States and Europe.
But wasn't there one, and I'm not sure it was at this location, that you discovered and named?
Well, let's see. Over here we have a crinoid, which is called Delocrinus missouriensis. And, of course, that is the fossil which the state fossil is based on.
Now, it became the state fossil because of some school children, right?
Well, right. Here we have another photograph here, which is taken in about 1989 here. It shows the then Governor Ashcoff signing the bill that made the fossil, Delocrinus missouriensis, the state fossil.
So this sea that you say covered Kansas City at the time, did the sea have a name at that time?
Well, we call it the Cherokee Sea, but that's just local. Actually, the seas probably entered where West Texas is to now, and then they transgressed eastward across the interior of the North American continent to the foot of the rising Appalachian Mountains. But they covered the entire mid-continent, which was near sea level. And, of course, if sea level was raised by a few hundred feet, well, then that sea would pulsate hundreds of miles across the interior of the continent. And if the sea level dropped by 400 or 500 feet, then the sea would retreat. And for a while, Kansas City may have been on a shoreline of a retreating sea. And then following that sea westward was a vast rainforest, like you see in this other diorama here, which had on it a lot of strange-looking plants. Most of these were trees back in those days that stood, some of them over 100 feet high, such as this one here. It had a bark on it that resembled a snake skin. Now, they find those sometimes in mines. Coal miners, of course, as they're mining coal, they'll find a particular specimen like that. They think it's a fossilized snake, but it isn't. It's part of one of the barks of what we call a scale tree or a lepidodendron tree.
This is a pretty large, it looks like a dragonfly almost, but a very large-sized dragonfly that would have lived in this area.
Well, that is some of the types. Now, see, you're going back a long time. The dinosaurs were still 50 million years in the future. We had no real flowering plants then. And, of course, no mammals. Now, that dragonfly there, it had a wingspan of about 18 inches. And actually, a fellow the other day sent me a specimen, or at least a photograph of a specimen that he'd found in a wall down in Lee Summit. And so it was probably around here. And so they probably, that particular block of the building stone there probably came from a quarry near here, but we don't know that for sure. But you see also the first reptiles we find in rocks near Garner, Kansas. Those were about the size of a lizard. Of course, this one here in our diorama is eating a large cockroach. Some of those were 4 inches long, but cockroaches have been around for millions of years.
They seem to be the ultimate survivors, don't they?
Well, of course, they've found hundreds of different species in most of these eastern beds of rock over here. But one of the interesting trees there is a fern tree. And some of those got to be 40, 50 feet high. Now, notice at the end of one of the fronds is a seed. That is the first seed, and that particular seed from a fern tree gave rise to all of the flowering plants of today. We have a specimen of it here in the case.
You have like a cross-section here of a Missouri River bluff, and it looks like there's all different types of limestone. What's the significance of the different types?
In this particular photograph here, we have two different rock types. Those are the major rock types in Kansas City. One of them is limestone, which forms a ledge. It's usually light-colored. And then, of course, the rock directly underlying it in this photograph is shale. Now, those particular couplets, limestone and shale, are repeated again and again and again throughout the greater Kansas City area. Now, the significance of those particular beds is that the limestone contains the marine fossils we've been talking about, and the shale beds will have at least within them a zone of plant fossils. So what we're seeing here is we're reconstructing the environment in which those beds were laid down. Now, limestone is formed usually from different types of shells and spines in that, of course, which accumulated on the seafloor. And then, of course, through geologic processes, they were turned into a homogeneous-looking limestone. Now, some limestones may, of course, be a chemical precipitate, but the limestones are marine. And the shale beds were either non-marine or very near shore, like a lagoon or a similar type of environment. So what we're seeing here, as you drive along the highways and you look at a bed of limestone, which usually forms the ledge, and the shale usually forms the slope, we're seeing the transgression and regression of seas across the interior of the North American continent is what we're looking at here. And that, of course, we believe that each transgression and regression took from 250 to 400,000 years. So you're dealing with a lot of time here. And in places, we've recorded at least 10 or 20 of these transgressions that are preserved in the rock layers as you drive along the highways.
Now, speaking of driving along on Highway 210 or North Kansas City, it looks like there's some windblown silt against the rocks there. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, let's see. If we're going to talk about that, we're going to have to move up in time here. Now, you see, what we've been talking about up until now is the various types of environments and rocks that were formed during the Pennsylvanian period about 300 million years ago. Now, the next group of rocks that are exposed in the greater Kansas City belong to the so-called Pleistocene epoch. We're moving up in time from 300 million years ago to less than a million years ago. Now, I've been asked by a lot of people, well, can we find dinosaur fossils in the greater Kansas City area? Well, I have to disappoint him and say no, because the interval of time that dinosaurs lived from about 225 million years ago to about 65 million years ago, the so-called Mesozoic era, we don't have any rocks here of that particular age. If they ever were here, they were eroded away. Most likely dinosaurs roamed throughout the greater Kansas City, and their skeletal remains were preserved in the rocks. But, of course, those rocks have been eroded away. So if you want to hunt dinosaur fossils, you got to go out in Colorado where those particular rocks are preserved. So notice on this geologic time scale here, from about the Pennsylvanian period 300 million years ago to less than only about 2 million years ago, we don't have any record, because those rocks, if they ever were laid down, they've been eroded away. So the Pleistocene are the so-called Great Ice Age rocks, and that, of course, is glacial drift is resting right on top of the Pennsylvanian rocks here. And so now we're moving up from a time when it was mostly invertebrates until we get into the age of mammals. Now on this wall over here, and in this case, we have a diorama here of what it looked like during the Great Ice Age. This illustration shows us a herd of Columbian mammoths crossing the Kansas River near Bonner Springs. Now, one of the major collecting sites for the skeletal remains of these Ice Age mammals, things like bears and beavers and sloths and that, are found in the Kansas River on sandbars. It seems that must have been a place where they could ford across. But notice here in this diorama, one of the very young mammoths is caught in a current, and probably it will drown, and then its skeletal remains will, of course, become entombed in the sandbars in the river, and some lucky fossil hunter will probably be able to find him, make a major find there.
So, kind of in conclusion, what would you want people to know about our Kansas City area in terms of a place where the geology and paleontology is alive and well, it seems?
Well, as I say, everything we know about what happened in the geologic past, we read from the rock records. So you have to get out and read the rocks. Now, see, I could probably tell you of several places where you could go to find fossils, but most likely they've pretty well been picked over. There's been a lot of people out there looking. My advice to any fossil hunter who wants to see what life was like back in the, back many years ago, drive along the highways or the roads and then find yourself an exposure of rocks, especially where there are layers, limestone and shale. The limestone will be like in ledges and the shale will form the slopes. And then it can be pretty well weathered. The more ratty looking or weathered looking is probably the better. And then find a place to park, and especially if there hasn't been anybody there in a long while, you can probably look over that outcrop and find some of the types of specimens that we see here in the cases.
UMKC Geosciences Professor Emeritus Richard Dentow is curator of the exhibit Kansas City Millions of Years Ago, Reading the Rock, on display at the Commerce Bank Box Gallery through May 31st.
After the break, three generations of poets reflect on motherhood and Puerto Rican culture. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
The poet Gloria Vando is known in Kansas City for helping found the Writer's Place, and writing runs in her family. Last year, Vando, her mother Anita Velez Mitchell, and her daughter Annika Paris published a book together that intertwines verses written by all three. It's called Woven Voices: Three Generations of Puerto Ricania Poets Look at Their American Lives. And although none of them live in Kansas City anymore, the book was edited by Linda Rodriguez and Scapegoat Press. Gloria Vando and her daughter Annika Paris were recently interviewed by Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air. In honor of Mother's Day, we're going to hear some of their conversation on Casey Currents today.
Tell me a little bit about the beginning of this book. I mean, what brought you to put this book together? Was it your idea or was it Linda Rodriguez?
Linda Rodriguez.
Oh, really? So she thought of...
Yes, it was her brainchild.
And the interesting thing was, as she was putting it together, we were like amazed at the similar themes, but so differently placed and so differently written because of, you know, a different experience. My grandmother's 96, and so her experience in life, seeing planes fly for the first time and modern technology just evolving in front of her, is one way of looking at life and the transition that happened in the world versus my mother's being in New York versus mine being in Texas. So it was interesting.
Since Anita's not here to do a reading, Annika, would you like to read one of her poems? I thought I might have you read The Milky Way.
Sure.
I thought this was interesting because Anita, who lives in New York City, still mentions the Kansas sky in this. And it has something to do with family relationships. Okay.
This is called the Milky Way. I am in empathy with the Kansas sky. Ghost clusters of clouds bring back my childhood when I stretch out on the welcoming grass and see, deep into space, my absent mother. Here she is again, moving tenderly across my aching heart, her florid skirt turning from white to deep purple as she hides, then reappears, as if pulled back and forth by a sacred hand. Mommy, I cry out into this ghost-loved world, but there is no echo to my call from afar. Like a glow swathed in dust set to keep us apart, my mother's ghost fades away to make way for a star.
That's lovely. That's got that sense of longing, you know, not only longing for a country, but longing for the connections that we all want to have in our lives.
Well, it was interesting because my mother was brought up by her aunt. I was brought up by my grandmother. My grandmother was brought up by a stepmother because her mother died during childbirth. And so we each had someone else raise us. And when I had children, I thought, well, this is a neurotic pattern and it stops with me. I'm not going to do this. These are my children and I'm going to take care of them. But it's quite interesting, this sense of longing that is apparent.
Hmm. It must be really kind of interesting now to see some of these poems juxtaposed with each other, because we just heard Annika read her grandmother's poem, The Milky Way, and Gloria, you have another one, if you flip the page, that's called Islands, Isla Madre, Isla Nena, and it's interesting if you compare these two.
Yes. My mother was brought up on Vieques, which is a barrier island of Puerto Rico, and it's called Isla Nena because it's small, so it's island child island, and Isla Madre is mother island. So they say that the child is nestled in the arms of the mother.
Ah.
Yeah. So this is Islands, Isla Madre, Isla Nena. And there's an epigraph by Thor Heyerdahl. I'm convinced the ocean is a conveyor, not an isolator. My mother stands at the water's edge on the barrier island of Vieques. She waits for her mother to come to her. Sunday after Sunday she waits, the water stretching to that other shore in the impossible geography of her extended heart. As a child, I too waited for my mother to come, Sunday after Sunday, behind the wrought iron fence that quarantined the schoolyard, I waited. The whiteness of a car, any car, revving my heart's sappy rhythm. And still we wait, we two, still, so still, each on our own atoll, each in our own sorrow. Though I suspect the ocean could drown the land and take my mother to her mother by the hand, leaving me bereft.
Islands, Isla Madre, Isla Nena. That was Gloria Vando. And that's also included in the book Woven Voices, and it follows the Milky Way. They both have a similar sense.
Yes, the longing for mother.
We're listening to a segment from New Letters on the Air today. Angela Elam interviewed two of a three-generation poetry team, mother Gloria Vando and daughter Annika Paris. Paris is also a composer. She and her sister recently wrote a musical based on one of their grandmother's poems, which is also in the book, Woven Voices. The poem's called Temple of the Souls and is about the original inhabitants of Puerto Rico. The music you've been hearing comes from the show. Here's the poem that inspired the musical.
You know what we could do, which might be kind of fun? Gloria, I could have you read in Spanish, and then Annika, you could read in English, and we could go back and forth that way. Would you guys like to try that?
Why not?
Totem Taíno. El Taíno vivía en las cumbres. La paz era su nobleza.
The Taíno lived on the mountain. Peace was his noble bequest, to evade his enemy, the Caribe. He took refuge in the caves, a bow and arrow, his sole defense. When the avaricious infidels disembark on his shore, with their smugness and swagger, their dogs and firearms ready for war, they plunder his mountains, profane his cultures, his caves, rape his women, enslave his children, steal his gold, and shatter his arc and his bow.
Muere el cacique Aguaybana, el valeroso guerrero.
Their leader, intrepid and bold, his skin tattooed in colors on his chest, a medallion of gold, and hanged from a flamboyant tree. His soul ascended to heaven, but his cry remains entombed in the heart of his hollow cave, locked in our conscience forever, where his spirit still claims us today. Sobs reverberate, thick tears drop in the cavernous womb of Mother Earth. Time has softened our pride and melted our hearts of stone. In the sweetness of our fruits, the essence of our flowers, and the beauty of our land, the Taíno soul lives on. Let us pray those evil intruders never dare return to destroy a nation and enslave a people on their own soil as they did back then. Let the oceans rage and rise. Let the lava from Borinquen flow. Let it cleanse our guilt and guide us back to the Arieto, back to the ritual chant of the Taíno.
Taíno de amor y paz, Borinquen.
Taíno of love and peace, Borinquen is your homeland. We offer you, blessed spirits, a gold mine of regret.
Te imploramos, ay bendito Dios, una mina de perdón.
We implore you, ay bendito Dios,
perdón, perdón, perdón.
Forgive us, forgive us, forgive us.
Poet Gloria Vando and her daughter Annika Paris recently spoke to New Letters on the Air's Angela Elam about the book they've published in collaboration with Paris's grandmother, Anita Velez Mitchell. It's called Woven Voices. Three generations of Puerto Rican poets look at their American lives. This segment was part of a longer interview that aired on New Letters on the Air and was produced by Angela Elam and Stephanie Hughes.
Any given weekend, Kansas City, Missouri's Midtown venues host the city's biggest music scene. But lots of music lovers get left out of the fun. Like bands that have members under 21, those that don't want to be a part of the bar scene, or those that are just too weird. That's why in 2011, a handful of artists and musicians started Focal in Kansas City, Kansas. They wanted to provide a non-commercial stage away from the bars. Next weekend, Focal will host its biggest annual event, a weekend-long experimental music showcase. Alex Smith reports.
The Focal Music Venue is nothing if not humble. It's located in the dark, cool basement of a former grocery store in Strawberry Hill. Focal also used to occupy the main floor, but it recently moved all operations downstairs. Inside, the stone walls are covered with elaborate graffiti pieces, and against the south wall, there's a wooden stage about 2 feet high off the ground. There's no bar, no big sound system, no stage lights, and as Focal organizer Martin Swank explains, it makes no money.
This is a money-losing project, for sure.
For Martin Swank and co-founders Allie Mason and Craig DeMoss, Focal began as a labor of love about 2 years ago, and it's remained so ever since. Shortly after moving in to live on the second floor of the KCK building in 2011, Swank and his roommates decided to rent more of the building to use as an art gallery. But the gallery soon morphed into an all-ages, alcohol-free stage for punk and other offbeat bands. Focal wanted to fill the void left by the closing of similar underground venues like the Studded Bird and the Firehouse. Martin Swank says Focal was also inspired by the do-it-yourself approach to music of his teenage years.
You go to shows growing up that are almost in houses or in basements similar to this. There's no door guy harassing people, and it's just a really comfortable place to be, and we wanted to provide that in the neighborhood that we lived.
Last year, two of Focal's regular performers decided they wanted something more than a one-night gig. Diedrich Moore of Monta at Odds and Justin Wright of Expo 70 wanted to bring together their friends and favorite experimental bands for something like a mini Woodstock with 3 days of peace and droning vintage synthesizers. Moore explains that the result was the first annual Psych Fest.
We intentionally picked bands and picked a location and picked an atmosphere that you really have to want to come be part of it. It's not like you're at a bar next door and you just happen to hear this thing going on and you come over. So everybody who came here made the trek to get over here to KCK and had the purpose of, I want to see something interesting and I want to experience something unusual.
Moore says this year's festival will be even bigger, with 21 bands in two different venues, Focal and HQ, which is also in KCK. In addition to music, the festival will include light and projection art. But while the organizers look forward to an expanded festival, they're committed to a non-commercial, sponsor-free event.
We all have day jobs, so I think if this was something where, you know, our lives depended upon it, then we would approach it differently, but this gives us the freedom to kind of choose really what we want to hear, what we want to do, and who we want sponsoring and not sponsoring, and just frees us up to really just do it exactly how we want to do it and have fun with it.
Both Kansas natives, Moore and Swank, also hope PsychFest will draw attention to a commonly ignored part of the city. Morgan says the low cost of living has attracted lots of artists and musicians to the area in recent years, but most audiences still seem to overlook KCK and Wyandotte County.
As a dot, as we call ourselves, there's always motivation for us, you know, within the neighborhood to try to show the good side and the benefits and the neighborhood that a lot of people pass over as they're just sort of driving by on I-70. And I think there's a lot of great people, a lot of diversity. So, yeah, anytime I can promote the inner city of Kansas City, Kansas, and to show it's vibrant and it's up and coming and people are excited to be here, sort of one of my personal missions.
In addition to Monta at Odds and Expo 70, the lineup will include touring bands and local groups like Metatone, Conquerors, and Umberto. PsychFest 2013 will take place Friday and Saturday. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.